Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Columbus City School Superintendent Talisa Dixon has increased the minimum reading score that third graders must achieve at the beginning of the year. The move means that 97% of the district's third graders will be placed on a reading improvement plan this school year. Teachers have protested the move, saying it's a plot to inflate state report card scores and that it will shift too much attention away from students who really need help. Benita Smith is a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
Emily Hamford is a senior education correspondent with American Public Media and the producer of the audio documentary Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? She joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Emily, what do we know about why we teach reading the way we do? And I know that's a huge sweeping generalization, but just in general, when did reading become something that was taught?
Oh, it's an interesting question. We have been arguing about how to teach reading for a very long time. We didn't have to read until we invented written language, which is relatively recently in the course of human history. So one of the big things to keep in mind when it comes to learning how to read is that as a species, we are not born with brains that are evolved to do it. We're not meant to read, essentially. We can become really, really good at it, and many people do become very good at it, but many people don't. And I think we are facing a situation in this country where there are a lot of children who are not being taught to read in ways that really line up with what scientists have figured out about what needs to kind of happen in your brain to change your non-reading brain into a reading brain, basically. So there are a lot of kids who are not being taught in ways that really help them learn, and they have a hard time learning. And learning to read is actually pretty difficult for a lot of kids. Some kids learn to do it without much instruction, but most kids really need good instruction to become good readers. And we're in a situation in this country where I think our reading achievement, we're underperforming in reading because we're not teaching it well.
And how long has that been going on? Just statistically, how long have we been lagging in that way?
Well, we don't have good apples to apples comparisons to compare ourselves now to 50 years ago or 100 years ago. I mean, the best we have are the nation's report card, the NAEP results, which just a new set of NAEP results just came out and did not reveal great news about how we're doing on reading. And those tests, in sort of an apples to apples way, you can go back to 1992. So we can kind of compare ourselves to ourselves. Starting in 1992 using the NAEP tests. And what you can see on the NAEP tests is that we really haven't made much progress at all in reading since 1992. We have seen some closing of the gaps between lower-income kids and kids of color and white kids. But what you see actually in the most recent results is that the kids who are really sort of good at reading are getting better and better at it, but sort of the middle and the lower are not getting much better at it. And we're actually in a situation where there's only one state in the country that's making progress on fourth grade reading, and that's Mississippi.
Hmm. Well, Mississippi, I'm just going to venture a guess here, was probably bottom of the barrel.
Yes, and that explains something, obviously, mm-hmm. when scores go up. Mm-hmm. But we can talk more about this later in the program mm-hmm. if you want. Mississippi has been making some really concerted and targeted efforts to try to improve reading. And what you're doing in Ohio, what you just described at the beginning of the show, I think that's one part of it, is to sort of pass laws that say kids need to be on plans, special plans to improve their reading, or they're not going to pass third grade if they don't score at a certain level. That's one of the things Mississippi did, but Mississippi recognized that passing a law like that or having a focus like that isn't enough. There's a lot of other pieces to the puzzle. And for many years now, they've been trying to attack various pieces of the puzzle when it comes to improving reading.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Emily Hanford. She's a senior education correspondent at American Public Media and producer of the audio documentary. It came out in August. It's called Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? Also with us is Benita Smith. She's a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School. Benita, it just seems like given this, the importance of reading, it's almost as if kindergarten, first, second, and third grade teachers, that's all you should be doing is teaching them to read. Does it feel like that?
That is our main job at those grade levels. I think a lot of our students come in significantly behind. And so even a year's growth that we are asked to make doesn't seem like much considering their starting point. And so I personally believe I would like to see primary grades focus on reading and writing, not exclusively, but the majority of our time. We do have a 90-minute literacy block, which we're required to teach consecutive 90 minutes. And so that does help with reading instruction and implementing small groups.
When you think about your life as a teacher and your preparation to be a teacher, how much was the reading piece a part of that?
Wow, that was a long time ago. So
you're not that old.
Thank you. I've seen a lot of reading programs come and go in 31 years. There's been literature-based, there's been whole language, there's been phonics-based, and now most recently balanced literacy. So there are a lot of approaches to teaching reading. And I think what happens in a lot of districts, not just Columbus, is that we find an approach, we try to implement it for a few years, and before we can really get it down to where we're seeing some progress or some gains, something new comes along, and then we switch to that.
Does that sound familiar, Emily Hanford, in your research?
Yes. Benita is, I think, identifying something that is a really big problem, which is a kind of pendulum swing and something that we do to teachers where there's one program here, or one idea here, and then that seems to not work and we do something else over here. And that's a big problem for teachers. But I think when you look sort of big picture at the whole thing, one of the things that we need to be asking better questions about is What are sort of the ideas about how reading works that undergird those various approaches? Because what got me into this topic as a reporter, I've now been reporting on early reading instruction for 3 years now. I've become a little bit obsessed by it. And the big takeaway here is that psychologists, cognitive scientists, neuroscientists have been doing a whole bunch of research over the past 30, 40, almost 50 years now to try to understand how we read. Like, how does skilled reading work? How do we learn to do it? What does a kid need to be taught? And what's up when kids aren't learning? Like, what is going on when kids are having a hard time learning how to read? And there's this really fascinating, really useful mountain of evidence about how reading works. And a lot of that has not been well informing instructional approaches, teacher preparation, and teacher professional development.
Why is that?
That's a really good question. I think it's because, I think one reason is because reading has been an argument for a long time. There have been some very emotional debates about how reading should be taught. And I think what happened really is that all of this research on reading was done by people who were not actually in schools of education. A lot of what the mountain of evidence that I just talked about coming from the cognitive scientists and linguists and neuroscientists, it's been sort of separate from what happens in the world of education. And we now are just, there's this kind of chasm between the two. And there's sort of distrust on both sides, I'm afraid, of sort of the people who've been doing the research on reading and then the practitioners and the people of schools of education who are trying to teach how to teach reading. There's just been a big distance between those two. And it's time for us to shrink the distance. It's time for us to heal the divide and to have all of this research on reading really start to better inform instruction to help in a productive way teachers like Benita, to help teachers really get this knowledge into their hands and for them to understand we know a lot about reading, a whole lot. And I think a lot of teachers are led to believe that we maybe don't know that much about it. We'll try this and we'll try this. And many teachers aren't taught really how skilled reading works in their teacher preparation programs. And so a lot of teachers just don't know this research.
Yeah, I mean, given the importance of it, you know, they always say up through the third grade, you learn to read. And then from the fourth grade on, it's you read to learn. And so if you can't learn to read proficiently by the fourth grade, Benita, you're doomed, all things being equal going forward. You're hearing what Emily Hanford's saying. What do you think about that? You're nodding in some spots.
Yeah, I would agree. I would actually back that up, that if students aren't reading or on track by the end of second grade. Hmm. I think it's harder, not impossible. It is harder to get them back on track in the
kind of flip that
in
switch.
The third grade. Yes, because they've practiced so many, for lack of a better word, bad habits that they're pretty much ingrained. And so now at third grade, our main focus is on the comprehension piece. And so if students don't come to us with the decoding and the phonics and phonemic awareness, then we can't teach them the comprehension piece, which is what the test is based on, is on comprehension.
And also, even, you know, in any given school, in any given classroom, there has to be a whole universe of potential out there. All different people are coming in with all different speeds and all different kinds of layers of understanding of reading.
Absolutely. So just this morning before I came here, I had a meeting with a parent who's concerned about her daughter's reading in the third grade. And one of the assessment tools that we use is the benchmark assessment system, which gives students a level at the beginning of the year. And as a third grader, her child is tested at a level B, which is kindergarten. And so I've got a third grader who is reading and performing at a kindergarten level, but will still be expected to pass the test. And I'm expected to get her to pass the test by the end of third grade.
And Emily Hanford, this is where you're thinking these rules and regulations that states set up aren't really helpful in these kind of situations.
I think they can be helpful. Okay. And I think states like Mississippi and some other states are showing that they can be if there are other pieces in place. I mean, if you just put in a law or a regulation that says kids need to be here by this date, and if not, their teachers are going to get dinged or they're going to be held back. If you don't put into place with that, efforts to help teachers understand this knowledge, to help teachers understand what's been learned about reading, to look carefully at the curriculum and materials that you're using to teach reading, and to make sure that they're not, as Benita said, teaching kids bad habits, for example, about how to read words and the things that need to be in place to become someone who can really comprehend what you're reading by third grade and do well on those tests. We need to look carefully at the assessments. Benita just made reference to the various levels that kids are supposed to be on. And there are some really important questions to ask about whether assessments that are putting kids on these letter grade levels are telling us enough about what's really going on with them.
Right.
In the early grades, like if a kid is in kindergarten and struggling and they don't get the right kind of help, they're still going to be struggling, the research shows, in third grade.
It's not necessarily something developmental that you can grow into.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, one of the big takeaways from the science is that it's not a natural process, learning to read. Now, some people learn to read really easily. Some people need very, very little instruction. Having sort of access to lots of books and some good basic understanding of how sounds and letters work, which they can pick up sometimes almost on their own or from sitting on their mom's lap and doing a lot of reading. Like, some people's brains are such that that is just not difficult. Mm-hmm. And it does come together for them kind of in spite of the instruction they get. But probably half or maybe more of kids, that's not the case. They're really going to need some good instruction and understanding how sounds and letters work to be able to develop all of those skills to become a good reader by third grade.
And was this the case 100 years ago when I was in grade school and I was in the Bluebirds, which was the top group, and then there were all those other groups that you really didn't pay any attention to, and nor ever felt like anyone was particularly failing. But this has been consistent over time. We've had this problem.
Yeah, I don't think there was a, as far as I can tell, there's not like a golden age when we
right.
taught reading so much better. But again, it makes sense that there wasn't a golden age 100 years ago or 50 years ago, because we didn't actually know that much about reading back then. But now we do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the big news. We know all this stuff about mm-hmm. reading. So it's time to make sure that the teacher training and the assessments and the laws and policies and the curriculum materials line up with this science. And right now, in many cases, they just don't line up that well.
Well, we're going to have a cognitive scientist join us when we return. That's Emily Hanford. She's a senior education correspondent at American Public Media and producer of the new audio documentary. It came out in August. It's called Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? Also with us, a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School, Benita Smith. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Turn what you love into a career. On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Reading education in the U.S. has developed incrementally over the years with fits and starts. New methods are often paired with older methods, depending on district curriculum and teacher experience. And we're talking about how the skill of reading is taught. Still with us is Benita Smith. She's a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School. Also with us, Emily Hanford, a senior education correspondent with American Public Media. She's the producer of an audio documentary that came out in August. It's called Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? Mark Seidenberg is a cognitive scientist and professor at the University of Wisconsin and author of Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Mark Seidenberg, how do you study how we read? How does that work? What are you looking at?
Well, we look at the things that are going on underneath the hood. You know, when you're reading, it's hard to tell what is going on in the brain. What you can understand, what you can observe is whether someone understood a text, whether they could answer questions about the text. You can see the result of all the stuff that's been going on in the brain. We actually use various methods to try to unpack all of the mechanisms that give rise to the overt behavior we experience as reading. We go into the lab and bring people in to look at them under controlled circumstances. We look at various aspects of their behavior. We put them in brain scanners, but we also go into schools and we look at kids in their educational settings as well.
And what sort of things are you looking at when you maybe would sit in on Benita Smith's class? What would you be looking at?
Well, I wouldn't just sit in on the class because okay. The class is a complex environment in which lots of different things are going on. And that's a situation that makes it hard for a scientist to pull apart what's really happening and what is the child learning from the ongoing flux of events. We try to pull kids out of classrooms to be able to look at more specific behaviors. But what we're really looking at is who's making progress, what kinds of difficulties are they having, and what are the causes of those difficulties. And the goal is to have the research feedback on the kinds of things that teachers can do in their classrooms to allow more kids to succeed.
It sounds like, to me, Benita Smith, Mark Seidenberg's asking all the questions that you must be asking every day.
Yes, there's so many issues that you need to identify. And when you have a class of 25, 28 students, it becomes difficult to get to each one of them individually because they all have different paths to learning how to read. And so even though we try to group them in a small group, each with some commonalities of their reading strategies that they're using, it still comes down to having some one-on-one attention with each student to get to their specific need.
Mark Seidenberg, do most kids learn to read in school?
Well, it's a tough question because it's very hard to take. For a lot of kids, it's hard to tell what's going the result of what's happening in school versus things that are going on outside of school. So what I've been looking at is the extent to which a lot of teaching practices really assume that there'll be support in the family outside the classroom to really help kids get the practice and help kids get the specific skills that they need. In other words, the classroom can only so much can be done in the classroom for the reasons she just said. Mm-hmm. There's only so much time allocated to reading, and there are a lot of kids and a lot of things to be done. What happens now is a lot of curricula assume, approaches to reading instruction assume that there will be a parent in the home who can actually follow up and do a lot of work with the child to develop skills and practice things and add to and go far beyond what's available in the limited teaching time. My problem with that is that it works better for some people than others. In particular, it doesn't work very well if the child is from a lower income background where there isn't a parent in the home who can actually do this kind of provide this kind of assistance, where there aren't the resources to get on the internet and look things up and download materials, where the people don't have the funding to hire a reading specialist or go to a learning center if the child is struggling. Essentially, it's a combination of what's happening in the classroom and outside the classroom. And unfortunately, what happens outside the classroom isn't equally available to all kids. And it's a kind of way in which our assumptions about education can exacerbate the effects of income inequality. Not everybody's got the resources mm-hmm. to supplement what's going on in the school.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're spending this hour talking about how we teach reading, what works, what doesn't, and why. You just heard from Mark Seidenberg. He's a cognitive scientist and professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he's author of the book Language at the Speed of Light, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Also with us is a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School. She's been teaching for 31 years, Benita Smith, and Emily Hamford by Skype. She's a senior education correspondent at American Public Media and producer of the audio documentary Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to get to these cross assumptions, because I think probably Benita Smith, a lot of parents assume the kids are going to be taught in school. They're working two or three jobs. They can't afford to buy books and have them all over the place, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, there's assumptions on both sides. But let's hear from Joseph first in Columbus. Joseph, you're on the air. Hi.
So I got a couple issues. You know, Mr. Seidenberg had actually mentioned something that you just re-mentioned.
Yeah.
The whole issue with the expectation that children will be helped at home by their parents mm-hmm. is completely wrong. We live in a society these days that if both parents don't work, especially if it's a single parent situation, mm-hmm. the children, there is no time for a parent to work with these children. And I am in this situation. Number two, but my child, I've had experience in both the lower income side of the Columbus City Schools and the higher income or the moderate income socioeconomic neighborhoods with the a school position. And my daughter is considered gifted in reading and in cognitive skills with the City of Columbus, which means her MAP score or whatever is high enough that, well, she's in the gifted program.
Okay.
And her score is higher than way higher than the minimum for the nation. However, because of this new rule, she is on a program that I, you know, had to sign off on.
Yeah, and the one we talked about at the beginning of the show, right?
Right, and my concern with this is the focus on what she really needs the help with in regards to reading is not going to be covered. And I've spoken with her gifted reading teacher, and this is kind of an issue because, like, she has problems with with reading and with the, understanding the text she has no problem with, but it has an issue with vocabulary is her problem. But see, the vocabulary doesn't seem to be as much as the focus in regards to what she needs the help with.
The kind of help she's getting to get that higher score does not focus on vocabulary, which is what she needs help with. Benita Smith, you're nodding. I mean, this is part of the criticism of requiring that third graders at the beginning of the third grade year now must achieve they're changing it from 181 to 212 on an assessment. That's a big leap. That's bigger than any other school that the Columbus Dispatch was able to identify in Central Ohio or the state.
Correct. And so one of the things is that we were caught off guard. We did not know that this change was coming until maybe a week before school started. Mm-hmm. And so what that says to me is that this was a move that was not about student achievement necessarily, because there weren't any mechanisms put in place at the end of second grade.
Okay.
To help those students, because none of the scores at the other grades have been adjusted for third grade to reach 212 at the beginning of the school year.
And or you have to get the special help.
Correct. Or we're assuming that our second graders went to summer school, had some summer assistance, because there is research that states that students, there's a summer slide, mm-hmm. Where students' test scores may, or their comprehension or their access to books declines over the summer, and they're not doing as much because they're not in a highly structured environment such as school. And so then they come at the beginning of the year, and in some of our schools, we literally started testing within the first week of school, because we have a window in which this needs to be done. And so we literally had no advance warning that this was going to be the new score.
It's, you know, this reminds me of what we were talking about early on, Emily Hamford, kind of switching gears in this way. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's really important for parents and taxpayers and policymakers. If a policy is put in place, what you're describing in Columbus, the question is, so what are you doing to then support the kids and the teachers? If you want everyone to be at a higher level, what are you doing to get there? And that is a really important question to ask, because it is sort of destined to be a failed policy if you're not thinking about what you're going to do about it. Another thing that I would like to address that came up earlier that I think is a really important point about family income, mm-hmm. and this is sort of what got me into this topic. So, you know, the important thing to recognize is that family income certainly does play a role when it comes to reading ability, but why is that? So I'm going to get to that in 1 second. But the other thing that's really important to understand is that there are lots of kids from highly literate homes, from fairly affluent homes, who struggle with reading words. By some estimates, maybe a third of kids from college-educated homes struggle with the basics of figuring out how to read the words on the page. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to kind of look at the basics of the science for answers to this. And Mark Seidenberg is much more of an expert on this than I am. But I can tell you that a big aha for me was just understanding that there are sort of two important basic components to reading comprehension, which everyone recognizes is the goal. We want everyone to be able to understand what they're reading. That should be the goal of all reading instruction. The question is, how does a little kid get there? What happens at the age of 5 when you already know? So when you come into school as a 5-year-old, you already have a lot of one half of the equation when it comes to learning how to read. So one half of the equation is your language comprehension, which has nothing to do with reading words on the page. Just as the caller described, what vocabulary do you know? Like, what words do you know the meaning of? What's your level of just spoken language understanding and ability? That is basically, there's this thing called the simple view of reading, which was proposed in the 1980s, and it describes reading comprehension, and one half of it is just all the words you know the meaning of and the knowledge you have. And then the other side of it is your ability to, like, identify words in print, to decode them. So when a kid comes into school, they already have something on the language comprehension side of the equation, right? And we know that that can depend on family income. Some kids know the meaning of lots of words. They have a sophisticated spoken vocabulary, and that can often correlate with the kinds of opportunities you've had in terms of books and experiences and your parents' educational level and the kinds of words they use with you in spoken conversation, right? So kids come in at different levels. But when you come into school, one of the things that most kids have very little of or nothing is the ability to decode words, to understand what the words say, how the letters represent sounds in words. So when you want to teach a kid how to read, if your goal is reading comprehension in third grade, you want to start by focusing a lot of emphasis on the decoding side of the equation, because that's what kids have very little of. So you want to teach them that. At the same time, you want to continue elevating their level of language comprehension. You want to do activities that build their knowledge of the world. You want to do science and social studies. We're in this ironic situation, as Benita mentioned earlier, where a lot of schools spend a lot of time teaching reading. There's 90 minutes of a literacy block. In some cases, there's twice that. And so we're in an ironic situation where we're spending a lot of time teaching reading, but we're not getting to the goal of better reading comprehension. And part of the problem is we're not necessarily doing that decoding side well, informed by the science. And we're spending so much time on the reading thing that there's documentation that we're not doing the science and the social studies and the building of knowledge that will allow a kid, when they get good at reading words, to understand what they've just read. So you've got two parts of the reading equation, teaching kids decoding and expanding their knowledge and vocabulary. And they're kind of separate things at first, right? You don't want to rely on a kindergartner expanding their vocabulary and their understanding through reading, because they don't really know how to read the words yet. So you teach them how to read the words, and then, and Mark can talk about this very eloquently, this thing starts to happen, which is known, as you said earlier, from the learning to read to reading to learn. Mm-hmm. There is this shift that happens when kids get good at reading the words, where most of the new vocabulary and new knowledge, their greatest tool in gaining new vocabulary and new knowledge, is through reading. But what happens is when kids don't get that down in kindergarten, first and second grade, they start falling further and further behind. It's called the Matthew effect. It's a biblical reference. The kids who don't get off to a good start sort of spiral down, and the kids who get off to a good start start spiraling up. And often that ability to sort of figure out what the words on the page say, that has as much or more to do with your sort of phonological ability, your brain's ability to understand the ways that sounds and letters work.
You know, Mark Seidenberg, there's actual things going on in the brain. Your brain is taking shape with all of this. We know that from brain scans, right?
Listen, every time we learn, something is happening in our brain. Every time we're engaged in activities like we are right now, things are going on in our brain and things are changing. So, yes, things are definitely happening in the brain.
But what about having to have both things happening at the same time, which is what a lot of these kids, by the time they get to the third grade, are stuck having to deal with, not to mention fourth and fifth and all the way up?
Are you talking about the reading skills?
Yeah, learning skills? The phonetic thing and how to decode, break the code, some people say, and then also trying to also learn vocabulary and expand your brain in that way.
You know, that those are things that have to be, those are the keys to the child's development, and the educational question is how to promote both of those kinds of developments.
At the same time,
one of the issues about vocabulary is that and the spoken language skills that Emily was referring to, reading depends on the child's spoken language, their vocabulary, their knowledge of the grammar, their knowledge of what things refer to. All that stuff is coming out of the spoken language from birth till the time they show up in school. A lot of the language differences that we see among children are happening in that period. That's before they even get to school. And so what that suggests is some of the language development issues really have to be dealt with before the kid either even gets to school, and then followed through with what as they enter school and go through the classroom. So there are ways to promote spoken language development. There are things that could be done in pre-K classrooms. There are conversational kinds of activities. There's making language part of the child's, an emphasis on language part of the activities. When the child is very young, that will put children on a more even level. When they finally do get to school, and things like learning the mechanics of reading so that you can go on and comprehend texts and learn from them can happen. It's not started, the issues about learning to read aren't starting with school. They're actually originating in the kid's early language experience. Those language experiences differ, and those language experiences need attention. And if they get more attention, it will make the process of learning to read, when the kid finally does get to school, a lot better, and more kids will be able to succeed.
We will continue our conversation. We're talking about how we teach children to read. We will be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how reading is taught. Still with us is Benita Smith. She's been teaching elementary for 31 years. She's a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School. Also, Mark Seidenberg. He's a cognitive scientist and professor at the University of Wisconsin and author of the book Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. And Emily Hamford, a senior education correspondent with American Public Media and the producer of the ongoing ongoing audio documentary Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Benita Smith, how do you talk to parents about what needs to happen at home when it comes to learning to read?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that Emily has mentioned and Mark has mentioned is talking to your children, exposing them to books. A lot of what kids come to school with obviously happens before they walk in our doors. And so just having conversations with your children about what they see in the world, we call that in education concepts about print or environmental print. You know, the golden arches is a universal sign, but what does that mean, McDonald's? I mean, they see these things in their environment. And so that's really kids' first exposure to reading. They'll recognize those things.
Stop signs. Yeah, all of that.
Correct. Yeah. And so we try to capitalize on that when they come in the school. I know a lot of parents try to teach their kids the ABC song, but what we're not teaching them is how to identify the letters. Knowing them is one thing, but to identify them, what they look like, the difference between the uppercase and the lowercase and the sound that they make, I don't know that parents are teaching that with their children to the extent that when they come into school, we can pick up from that and carry on with the teaching of reading.
You know, we had the caller, Joseph, who said that he definitely is one of those, he's a single parent and he doesn't have the time to do what that maybe the district assumes he has time to do. Is that an issue? I mean, there's people working several jobs. There's lots of people who are immigrants, and English is their second language, if at all.
Correct. And we have a high population at my school of students with English as a second language. Columbus City Schools has a high mobility rate, and so we have move around a lot. We have a lot of students who have trauma in their lives, live in homeless shelters, and so just getting to school is hard work for them and their parents. And so there's a lot that we have to do just to make them feel comfortable with the school environment. If they're not fed, if they're not warm, it makes it hard for them to even want to learn how to read. I honestly believe that parents want to do what's best for their children and want them to be more successful, but sometimes they just don't have the time or the tools in order to do that. And so they depend a lot on the schools, and we depend on them. And so there's just a lot that each party needs to do.
Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Hi. Very glad to hear this discussion. I do have two specific questions, but first let me identify myself as someone who failed reading and tutoring in the third grade, taught myself, and wound up at the other end of the spectrum. Okay, my question is, how do you deal with the difference between visual learners, of which I am one, and the other group that usually called auditory?
Mark Seidenberg?
Well, I have to say the research doesn't really support the idea that there are these kind of distinct groups of visual learners and auditory learners and multisensory learners and so on. People's brains are more similar than you might, than they are different. And the brain only has a certain number of ways of learning. It is true that some kids need a different pathway than the standard one for whatever, for some reason. If the standard sort of instruction isn't working for them, yeah, they need to have some other approach to get to skilled reading. On the one hand, pedagogy, educational practices emphasize the idea that every kid is different and the teacher needs to tailor what they do to the needs of the particular child. As a scientist, I think this is really going too far because every kid isn't so uniquely different that their experience has to be very, very specifically tailored to the kid. Moreover, there are more similarities than there are differences. But the other thing is, it's not fair to the teacher. It's not realistic for a teacher who's running a classroom with 30 kids and has many responsibilities, including ones that go beyond just reading, to try to be in the complexity of a classroom to try to figure out what is unique about each child such that they could create a personalized curriculum. I just don't think that's something that's actually realistic for teachers to do, and I don't think it's necessary either. The caller obviously wasn't benefiting from how he was being taught. He luckily, thankfully, found other ways to achieve. It's very hard to say from the outside what it was that was going on at the time, but I don't think we start with the idea that every child is different and every child's instruction has to be personalized. It's not realistic, and it's also saying that kids are more different than they really are.
Mort, thanks a lot for that call. This is a question. I want to turn to Alejandra now from Columbus. Alejandra, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having this great program on.
Thank you.
So I'm a parent of a child with dyslexia. He was both in Columbus City Schools and is now in Upper Arlington City Schools. But what I see as the biggest issue is to do with what Emily mentioned, which is teacher training. We really do have to help teachers. And I guess my question for the panel is, why are schools of education so resistant to teach the science of reading and to teach decoding in a serious way? And what can we do as members of the public to encourage them to focus more on these important aspects?
Yeah, okay. Alejandro, thank you for that call. Emily Hanford, you mentioned at the outset that there's a big disconnect between the likes of a Mark Seidenberg, who's a cognitive scientist at the University of Wisconsin, and what's being taught in teaching schools.
Yes, Mark writes about this very well in his book, so I recommend everyone go out and get it, Language at the Speed of Sight, because Mark really does try to dig into what is up with that chasm. Like, why is there such a divide? I think the important thing to recognize right now is that there is one. There is, in addition to what Mark has done, there are a number of studies and other things that have shown us that there is a divide between what teachers are being taught about reading. First of all, whether they're being really taught much of anything at all, about just how reading works. I've interviewed hundreds of teachers across the country at this point, and many of them have told me that they really just learned basically nothing about how kids learn how to read. So that's one issue. And then the issue is, I think in some cases, they're really taught some things that are actually kind of misleading. There are some ideas about reading development that the cognitive science and this other mountain of evidence have shown to be not on target. And many of those things are still informing what teachers are being taught about reading. So without realizing it, I think teachers are being taught some things about skilled reading and what it is and how it works in our brains and what needs to be in place for kids to learn how to do it that is just kind of off. And it's sort of muddying the waters and confusing the situation. And it means we have, as Alejandra, I think, referred to, we just have a We have a lot of stuff to solve now.
Well, you know, Mark Seidenberg, you're at the University of Wisconsin. Is your research translating into the classroom where they're teaching teachers at University of Wisconsin?
No. Yeah. I teach under an undergraduate class every year about the science of reading and its educational implications. I happen to be in a psychology department where people study things like language development, reading development, social development, all these other things that are important for kids' early learning. I have almost no connection with the School of Education, and certainly my course is not required for people who are training to become teachers. It's a symptom of really a division that exists across the country. I mean, it's not just at the University of Wisconsin.
Right.
There's two cultures. It's been this way for a long time. I trace out the history of it in my book. Schools of education are kind of islands on campus, and so and they're very well defended against other parties coming in and saying, look, we have other research which you could make use of. We have other research that would make it easier for teachers to succeed at their jobs. We should be getting together to kind of put together what you know about education and what happens in the classroom and what we know about how basic things about how children learn and reading works. Let's get together and formulate programs that combine our complementary sorts of expertise, and then many more kids will succeed and many more teachers will succeed. Those kinds of discussions don't happen. And it is a symptom of really a very deep division that exists between the education side and the science side across the country, in this country and other English-speaking countries as well.
Benita Smith, you know, as a product of a school of education, and I'm just going to make a leap here and think you probably have a master's degree.
I do.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about that division? It seems illogical to me, but I'm from the outside.
Yes, I think it exists. My undergraduate degree is from Ohio Wesleyan University, and we focused a lot at that time in the mid to late 80s on children's literature and whole language. And then when I came to Columbus City Schools, we were in a basal reader. And so then we switched to a lot of programs. And I think what I want, we're lucky in Columbus that we have the Ohio State University, and we've had access for our teachers to have training provided by professors at Ohio State. We talked off air about reading recovery and what intense reading instruction was for students and how we could see a lot of gains when that was applied to struggling first grade readers, which is where we try to catch a lot of students who are struggling, because at kindergarten, they haven't had enough school experience to really know if this is going to be an ongoing problem. We can see some early signs, but by first grade, we're really able to identify if this is going to be a continuing problem. And so that intervention at first grade is critical.
Given the importance of reading, do you think it gets enough time in teacher training, you know, in school, when you were learning to be a teacher, did you get enough training about how to teach reading?
I don't feel that I did. A lot of it has come through my experience in Columbus City Schools with the professional development that's offered. So my track that I've taken has been in reading intervention, writing curriculum. My master's is in curriculum and instruction. So writing, reading curriculum, working for the reading department. I've had professional development in reading recovery, Literacy Collaborative, all through Ohio State University. And so not a lot of our teachers are getting that exposure. We get it through instructional coaches, through train the trainer model. And so, but there have been things put in place to help teachers. They're now required to have a reading endorsement, which is more education. If they did not get that in their undergraduate program, they are now required to have that to teach reading in grades K through 3.
Well, Benita Smith, we were out of time, but I thank you so much for yours today.
Thank you for having me.
It's Benita Smith. She's a third grade teacher at East Columbus Elementary School. Also, Emily Hamford, senior education correspondent at American Public Media and producer of the audio documentary Hard Words, Why Aren't Kids Being Taught to Read? Emily, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Seidenberg, cognitive scientist and professor at the University of Wisconsin. His book is titled Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, too.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.